This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and you are listening to Kenai Conversations. On today's show, we are talking about books. Specifically, how to write them, how to publish them, and how to get people to read them. We're checking out two local authors whose work you can check out at bookstores, libraries, and other establishments where fine books are sold. We've got Mike Chihuly from Ninilchik, author of Alaska Fish and Fire, which came out in October. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
And Joseph Roberta of Kisilov, author of Life with 40 Dogs, Misadventures with Runts, Rejects, Retirees, and Rescues, which is a brand new release as of April 4th. Thanks for being here, Joseph.
Hey, Jenny. Thanks for having me.
So I could ask the first obvious question, what is your book about? But you both make it easy on readers in that the titles are pretty descriptive. Mike, Alaska Fish and Fire. You're a retired fishing charter captain and a fire chief in Ninilchik. So that scratches the surface of what you write about in the book. But what other layers are beneath the title?
Well, I've got a little bit of everything in there. I was told by experts or people who know that writing a memoir from the time I was a kid till I was an old man or getting close to end of life was not a good thing, but somehow it seemed to work in this case. I did add some childhood experiences and life experiences as a child, and then sort of kick the book off with arriving in Alaska in the late 50s. It's got some commercial fishing in it, some sport fishing in it, some hunting, outdoor adventures. I was on the State Board of Fisheries for 3 years, so I included a couple chapters there that have resource management and my experiences on the board. I also included a couple of years at the university there. Those were some really good years of my life. And so I recounted that in a couple of chapters. My wife and I also went out in the bush and spent a year with our two little girls over in the Wood River Lake system. And I've got two or three chapters in there on that. And then a lot of fire and EMS, dealing with people and their medical emergencies, as well as fires and my experiences as a chief and also as an EMT and firefighter. I was only a chief for the last 13 years of my career there. Before that, I was just a volunteer and had a lot of interesting experiences.
And Joseph, Life with 40 Dogs, Misadventures with Runts, Rejects, Retirees, and Rescues is pretty descriptive of you and your wife running a dog kennel and mushing competitively with dogs that basically other people threw away. But the title raises a lot of questions as well. For one, why did you have 40 dogs?
I wish I knew how I ended up with 40 dogs. I really do. But, you know, we moved here and one thing led to another. And then, you know, my wife and I ended up with all these dogs. And, you know, these are their stories. And these are definitely their stories. That's what I tried to really do different with the book, I think. Because there are a lot of great books out there on, you know, Alaska life. And there's certainly a ton of books out there on, you know, mushing and doing the Iditarod. But I really wanted to do a book that was a little different, and that I wanted to do two things. And one is I wanted to make the dogs the stars of the book. Like, I didn't want them to be just in the backdrop of a story about me or a story about Iditarod. I wanted these to be their stories. And then I also wanted to share what it's like to be a dog musher or even just a dog owner with this many dogs the other 50 weeks of the year that people don't hear about. Like, you know, in Alaska, especially when Iditarod comes out, we're saturated with it. And then in the winter, we get a ton of racing coverage and a ton of, you know, stories about mushers and their dogs and everything that goes on. But then the rest of the year, you don't hear about it. And these aren't skis, it's not a snow machine. We don't put them away. We're still interacting with them. We're still training them in a lot of ways. We're still feeding them and finding ways to feed them. And then just, you know, sharing space with them. And so a lot of the stories in the book are about that. It's about everything else that goes on between me and the dogs.
And in what point in your life, since this is very much your life shared with readers, did you decide, hey, you know what, this should be a book?
I'd wanted to write a book for a while. I never thought it'd be like a memoir type book, though. I thought it'd be more of like a science book, to be honest. But, you know, when you live with this many dogs, and especially like our dogs came to us from a variety of different ways. A lot of them came from the pound and different places like pounds, rescues around the state. And so they came in with a lot of quirky personalities and things, and they would just do these ridiculously insane adventures. And so, you know, you'd be at cocktail parties or at a barbecue or something, and you'd just start telling these stories about your dogs, and people would be cracking up, or, you know, if it was sad, they'd be, you know, feeling your sorrow with you. And very earnestly, people would say, like, you should write these down. You should put these into a book. And, you know, after a time, when enough people say that, you start to really think about it and say, like, gosh, if this many people are enjoying these stories, like maybe I should share them with more people than just my circle of friends. And so I think that was what sort of launched me to want to do it.
And Mike, how about you? When did you decide that you were going to write a book?
Well, that's interesting listening to Joseph there. It brings back memories and thoughts. You know, being a charter guide on Cook Inlet for 30 years, it gave me the opportunity to spend 8 to 10 hours in the boat with anywhere from 4 to 6 people. It's a long time in close quarters, day after day, all summer long, that the weather's good. And so you get into a lot of conversation, you do a lot of BSing, you tell a lot of stories besides, you know, the fun and adventure of it. But there's always the slow times. And so as the years went by, people always told me, you need to write a book, you need to write a book. And I thought, yes, yeah, I do need to write a book. But I was young then, and I was more a doer than a thinker. I think I had too many, you know, there was just too many other things with kids and animals and pets and activities and school and stuff. And it just, I didn't have a place for it then. I didn't have the time for it, I think. But I talked about it for probably 20 years. I need to write this book. And finally, I think a couple years ago, now that I've gotten older and kind of retired out of my business and, all of a sudden it hit me one day, if I don't write this book soon, I'm never going to get it done. So I finally decided to sit down and do it. And it's a formidable task. It was for me because I've written a lot of magazine articles in the past, but magazine articles, when you start, you can always see the light at the end of the tunnel, you know, 1,500 words, 2,500 words, maybe 3,000 words. And with a book, it just seems so formidable, so large. And where do I start? There are so many things to write about. And that was the hardest thing is just getting started, I think. But I decided I better do it a couple years ago. And I sat down when I made up my mind to it and wrote the book in about 2 months.
You mentioned writing various articles and things throughout the years. When did you get your start writing? What got you into it?
Well, you know, believe it or not, I have to give the credit to Chuck Keim, Charles Keim. He was a professor at the university in the 70s. I don't know if any of the listeners out there remember him, but he was a big game guide. He and Jimmy Bedford ran the journalism department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he was quite well known, quite a tall man. He wrote a book, I believe, called Fair Chase, and it was about Hal Waugh, one of the famous Alaskan guides. Anyway, in about my sophomore or junior year, I decided I had an interest in writing, although I hadn't done anything up to that point, and I needed to take an elective. And so I took a magazine article writing class. And it kind of tickles me to think about it because it was early September, and I went to the first class, and it was well attended. There was probably 25 students in there. And Chuck Keim got up in the front of the class, and the first thing he looked out over the class, and the first thing he told us was, if anybody in this room can publish between now and the end of the semester, you get an automatic A, and you don't have to take the final.
Nice.
So I had just got back from a moose hunt with a couple of buddies of mine. I went straight back to the dormitory. I had taken a whole bunch of slides. I sat down and wrote the story, put the slides in those little plastic containers like we used to and label them, put them in the mail. I sent them off to Jim Reardon at Alaska Magazine, and he published the story. And that was kind of the beginning, I think, for me.
Okay. Joseph, how about you? When did you get started writing?
Prior to coming to Alaska, I was a zoologist. And so I did a lot of more scientific writing. It was a lot of behavioral stuff on animals. And then when we moved to Alaska, was looking for work and could, could take it where I could get it. And so got hired on with one of the local newspapers that has pretty high turnover, and they're really, really eager to work with new and young talent to kind of groom them out. And so I got in with them and started doing some writing. And then over the last 15 years, I guess I've kind of written for all the papers around here and, you know, magazine stuff, like Mike was saying. And so that was probably the start, was just newspaper writing. And then also tried to, since my background was coming in from zoology and not, you know, I didn't have any kind of degree in writing or anything like that. I did take as many classes as I could over at the college in writing, and joined local writing groups. And I thought both of those were really great, if for no other reason than when you're in a class like that or you're in a writing group like that, you're going to get people's honest opinion about your work, which is really important. Because when you show it to your family and you show it to your friends and your wife, they're always going to tell you it's a lot better than it is. And when you give it to a room full of strangers, there's going to be at least one person in there who's got no problem telling you exactly like what's wrong with that story, but you need to hear it. And that's where you're really, I think, going to grow as a writer. And I did, you know, I did learn from all of those criticisms, even the newspaper criticisms, because to be a newspaper writer, you have to have pretty, pretty thick skin, because someone's always going to complain about something in the story. And a lot of times they're coming at you. And I think that's great. It's really shaped me to become a stronger writer and really make sure I'm not just telling a good story, but I'm writing a great story too, that the writing is strong. And those two things, I think, need to go hand in hand to have a successful book. Like, you can't just have a great story. It also has to be a really well-written story if you really want to have some success. So I tried to do both of those things.
I think memoir in particular is kind of an interesting genre. On one hand, maybe you don't need quite the level of creativity to come up with just a completely fictional story. I mean, it's your life. Part of it's documentary, but here's my fear if I were to ever write a memoir. We all live in very small towns, and the people we love and care about also live in our very small towns. And not that either of you two are doing anything controversial, but I always wonder if that's a challenge. Oh, man, this is a great anecdote, or oh, this really makes a great point, or oh, this would be a great scene, but I don't know if Cousin Sue would really want to be in the book, or oh, I don't know if Bobby really wants that shared with readers. Is that something that came up? How do you walk that line of being honest and being authentic and writing a really good story, and yet also maybe being cognizant of what friends and family and community members might want to see, might not maybe want to see?
Yes, absolutely. And I ran up against that. I, at one point, felt that I had a whole book of fire and EMS chapters, quite frankly, that I could have written and that are, to the right audience, intriguing and interesting and diverse in every way. But a lot of the stories I just didn't feel I could tell. It almost gets emotional for me. I guess I've gotten more emotional in my older age, but when you have people die in your ambulance and people's homes burn down and things like that, it's pretty tough. And it's tough to, you know, even I thought that I could change the names perhaps and still tell their stories. But too many people in Inilchik, in a small town, still know who I'm talking about. And it just didn't seem right. So anyway, it's a tough thing. And I certainly, you know, I could sit down with a fellow EMT in private in confidence and tell some real stories about things that happened to me over the years. But again, there's just a lot of the stories you just can't tell and feel good about it. And so I picked stories that I thought were a little more neutral and well-known in the community already, yet still interesting. And there was a couple that were pretty personal, but I went to those people and to their families in the case of deceased. And in one case, I had a family who wanted me to tell their relative story in hopes that it would help others. So,
Joseph, how about you? You've done journalism, writing other people's stories, and you've done some fiction writing. How does memoir compare? What do you like about it? What's challenging in that format?
Before I answer that, I just wanted to say too, because I know we're each here sort of talking about our own book, but I've read Mike's and I really liked Mike's. And I want to say, like, the question that you just asked is, I think, a really important one, because when I went into reading his book, I was a little nervous that I might not like it just because of the, you know, I knew the fishing and the hunting stories would be really easy to get through. And it was more of the EMS stuff that I was worried about. Cause I was like, oh, is this going to be a guy just, you know, kind of beating on his chest and, you know, what a great guy was saving all these things. And Mike didn't do that. Like the stories are like, they're sort of the intricate, like community fabric of being an EMT and being a firefighter and it wasn't any of that chest pounding. It was really these really like heartfelt stories that you could tell it felt like it was like it pained him to write those stories and share those things because he was still grieving over some of those things. And so I just wanted to say that I really did like those stories. And I felt that was a very honest thing, what he was just saying. What was the question again? I totally forgot the question.
So memoir, what do you feel like makes a good memoir? How much honesty, how much authenticity, how much kind of thought and care do you put into other people's roles in your stories? Where's that line?
I think you hit the nail on the head. It is a small community here. And so that is, it is a tricky thing because it's your book and you want to be honest about it, especially if, you know, they're your stories. But at the same time, like you said, you have to be really careful to not, you know, burn any bridges or insult anybody and at least too harshly. And I think that was probably for me the hardest part of sharing the book is the fun stories and the good times. Those are always really easy to share, but it's more of the darker stuff that makes it a little tricky. We've, you know, when you've had 40 dogs, you're going to have some that die like really untimely deaths and really horrible deaths. And we've had a few of those, and those were deeply personal experiences for me and my wife. And mainly because I don't want to say no one feels about their dogs that we do, but I know there's a spectrum of how people feel about their dogs. And for some people, they're just material possessions. Other, you know, they're working beasts, and some they're, you know, they're like their kids and everything in between. And we are very close to our dogs. They're very much like family members. And so when we lose one, it's like losing a family member. And those stories were really hard to share. And because, you know, you're putting yourself out there and you're putting your emotions out there for anyone to just walk all over, and there's invariably going to be people who don't see dogs the way you do and are going to say mean and hurtful things about it. And so that's a very scary and hard thing. And then I didn't necessarily start with, it's not like a life memoir. I didn't start at the beginning of my life, but all of these stories they're real recent. They're all about these dogs that I owned and still owned over the last 15 years. But I did have one part in the book where I talk about that my life was shaped by the very first dog that I owned. And it was a dog that my parents had brought home from the pound, and we kept it 2 weeks, and it was basically like a wild child. And then it went back to the pound. And I always felt really guilty about that. And I always sort of blamed myself. And then as I got older and realized, like, it wasn't necessarily my decision to make. I mean, I was a 7-year-old kid or something. It was as much my parents' responsibility and decision whether that dog stayed or went too. And I kind of go into that in the book. And you know, that's a tricky thing too, when you start talking about your family and the ways that they've shaped your life with things that maybe aren't necessarily positive things. And so it is. It's a really tricky thing to kind of balance that being truthful to yourself and not just stomping someone's guts out. It's a hard thing. And I don't know if I succeeded. I mean, I guess time will tell if I did or didn't.
Okay. And that is Joseph Roberta, author of Life with 40 Dogs. We are also talking to Mike Chihuly, author of Alaska Fish and Fire. You're listening to Kenai Conversation on 91.9 FM, KDLL, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. So both of you are first-time authors. Mike, your book came out in October, and Joseph's came out just a week or two ago here in early April. So let's talk a little bit about the writing process, since this is a first book for both of you. How did the nuts and bolts of when you wrote, how much you wrote at a time, how long did it take you? Was it challenging to find time to write, or are you kind of looking to do it every chance you get? Mike, what's your process look like?
You know, obviously it's different for everyone, and the process that I went through is perhaps, it might even be considered a little bizarre, but when I finally made up my mind that I was going to write this thing, I made up my mind to write it. And maybe to my wife's chagrin, because the door of the bedroom stayed closed and I remained focused as much as I could. I'm not a real good multitasker, and I can do one thing at a time, and so any distraction just really makes it difficult. So I think the biggest thing for me is going back to the size and the immensity of it. I just had a tough time, and so I kind of went with that joke or saying, you know, how do you eat an elephant? And the answer is one bite at a time. And so I told myself, look, you know, I don't know where to start. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know exactly what this is going to look like, but pick one thing that you know you want to be in the book and just start there. And so I picked a chapter. I think it was a chapter on the harrowing experience I had with a friend of mine up on a glacier goat hunting. And I thought, you know, this is a good story. So I sat down, I wrote that story, and it kind of took the nerves off. It kind of took the edge off. I got done with it and I looked at it and I said, well, you know, that wasn't so bad. So let's pick another one. So, you know, I've got a million stories. I could, you know, write several more books, I think. Whether I ever will or not is another question. But I picked another story. And after I wrote three or four of them, I started to feel better about the process. And I'd written, you know, then I wanted to balance it out a little bit. I think I wrote, one of the next ones I wrote was my set netting experiences in Bristol Bay as a young man. And then that kind of gave a time, a temporal aspect to it, because I had a chapter here of when I was in my teens, and then I had a couple, one chapter of hunting when I was in college, and then another chapter of hunting or fishing, guiding or something when I was older. So then I started to look at it more overall like a book, you know, like taking shape. And I thought, okay, you know, I need to write something about my guiding experiences. That was the one thing that people said the most, you need to write about, you know, because I would tell stories of things that happened to my clients and things we saw out there. And everybody asked you, you know, how far is it across the inlet? And what's the name of that mountain? And what's the strangest thing you ever saw? And what kind of sharks do you catch? And all this stuff. So I wrote a couple chapters on guiding. And then I thought, well, you know, I've been a fire chief a long time and an EMT and a firefighter. And so then I wrote a few chapters about it. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe I need to go back to the beginning and talk a little bit about where I started and how I got to Alaska. And it slowly, from a temporal standpoint, came together in that way. And I filled in a couple of the blanks could step back and look at it, you know, maybe like God creating the earth, you know, and say, okay, I still need this. I still need that. And so that's kind of how it happened for me. Like I said, once I got the couple of chapters done, I think it took the edge off and I kind of got some momentum, and I started in January and I was done, by mid-March. And, in some ways, you know, maybe I should have, people told me, you need to slow down. You need to look at it closer. You need to read them more often. You need to get them out, you know, but I was also kind of looking at it like a lot of Alaskans do, and that is, I don't want to be writing this book in the summertime. I want to be fishing. I want to be hunting. I want to be doing activities with my grandkids. I don't want to be writing. So I made up my mind I needed to get it done. And so I finished the book by mid-March, and then maybe that's another question, but it was quite an experience, the process it took with editing, publishing, finding the photos, writing the captions, dealing with the publisher, the layout. That actually took a lot longer than I thought. It took much longer than I took to write the book.
Joseph, how about you? What's your writing process?
Mine is just whenever I can sneak time in, and mainly because I still own 36 of these 40 dogs. And when I started writing this, I titled it 40 dogs. We'd had more than 40 at a time. I think I might have had 43 when I started writing this. And it took me about 3 years to put it together, and it was mostly just a time. It was a time deal. I write for a living, so a lot of times during the day when I could eke out an hour or two, I would be writing a story for whatever newspaper I was working for, or getting paid, or conducting an interview. And we were training dogs when we weren't doing that. And then we also had a daughter about 3 years ago, so then there was a lot of stay-at-home dad duties. And so a lot of these stories, they were dying to come out of me, and I had plenty. I still have plenty. I mean, probably only about half the kennels represented in the book. It was just a matter of time. A lot of these stories got written at like 2 to 3 in the morning, you know, just whenever I finally had time to sit down and in front of the computer and get a little bit of quiet. And that's when I would crank one out. And then I might not touch one again for 2 or 3 weeks, or, you know, I'd get through part of one and then have to come back and finish it. And that's always a rocky thing, 'cause you can kind of get into a frame of mind when you're in a story. And I really like to just do one from beginning to end, at least on a draft. And so a lot of times I wouldn't even start a story unless I was sure I could get out enough time to make it through the whole thing. So that was the trickiest part for me, was just trying to do it, writing these stories about the dogs while we were still living and training with all the dogs. Because like I said, for us, it's not just a winter thing. During the winter, we're training them all winter, but during the summer, we were swimming them, we were hiking them. You know, we were free running them and playing fetch with them, and then doing all the things with our daughter, and then also still trying to keep up with our house and our marriage and making an income. So it was just a tough thing to do, to squeak the book in there too.
Mike sounds like he was a kind of jump in and figure out the outline as you're going along. Did you do a lot of upfront planning work, or were you kind of, oh, I'm feeling this one right now, I'll write that, and then figure out how it all fits together after they're written?
Yeah, I was definitely more seat of the pants than planned them all out. And a lot of it, again, would be if the dogs hit a porcupine, and it was a major league deal to try to get through that night, you know, with the dog, with all the quills, and get home before work started. That was, you know, that was the story that I wrote. Or, you know, a lot of times if we lost a dog, like I said, to something untimely or just even old age, and it was a dog that we'd been with for, you know, 10 or 12, 15 years, I would write as like a cathartic, you know, like to get through it. And so sometimes it was just whatever was happening in my life at that time that I would try to get that story down. Because, you know, like Mike was saying, as time goes by, you don't want anything to start getting kind of the details soft. And so if it was something like, this is a story people would love, like I would try to get it down as soon as I could.
You are listening to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. This is Kenai Conversations. I'm Jenny Nyman, and I'm here with Mike Chihuly of Ninilchik, who has written Alaska Fish and Fire, and Joseph Roberta of Kisilov, who has Life with 40 Dogs. Both are recently released here within the last year. And they're both memoirs. They're both gentlemen from the Kenai Peninsula writing about their lives and the interesting things that can happen when you live in Alaska around animals and the wilderness and whatnot. And you both have very fine looking books sitting here on the desk in front of you, but you took somewhat different paths to get to that point. I know that aspiring authors in this area kind of think about, oh, I'd love to write a book. And then you get to the question, how exactly do I do that? In the past, it's been kind of the publisher is the route to go. You send out the query letter. You think about, do I get an agent? Do I not get an agent? How does all that work? And more lately, there are options for self-publishing, which have some positives and some negatives. And so I'm curious about the routes that you two took and what you feel like the strengths and maybe the weaknesses are, and maybe what advice you'd have for other people who are hoping to write in the future. So Mike, tell me about your path to publishing.
Well, let me just say that when I made up my mind to write the book, it was kind of a bucket list item, and I was going to write it whether any publisher wanted it or not. I told my wife, if this doesn't work out and the kids and nobody likes it or wants to read it or publish it, at least I'll have a manuscript and our grandchildren will know what their grandfather and grandmother are about. I was actually a little bit inspired by another lady in Ninilchik who did a similar thing, never actually published it. Her manuscript is still in typed page form with a paperclip, I think, on it, but it's actually in the library in Ninilchik. And she wrote it, and I read it, and I was amazed with it. But the only reason she wrote it is for her grandson. She wanted her grandson to know about his grandmother and other ancestors. And so that was similar for me. I'm sort of an impatient kind of person. I didn't look forward to sending my manuscript off to New York to some publisher and waiting 6 or 8 months to find out if he or she did or did not like it. So I made up my mind I was going to write the book, and I just kept my fingers crossed that someone would be interested. I ended up going to a publisher in Anchorage. I think I did that because, and the advantage to that, of course, I didn't know this up front, but was the fact that they were in Anchorage, and if I needed to talk to them, if there was a problem, I could get in the car, and within 4 hours, I could be face-to-face with them like I am with you, Jenny, now. So I thought that was an advantage, and I also thought that if I could get it published, it would be more of an immediate thing. I wouldn't have to wait. There are pros and cons to all of this, don't get me wrong, but that was sort of my strategy. When I went in to talk to my publisher, met him face to face, I think he was a little taken back because I was a little bit aggressive, and I think he expected me to be a little bit more subservient and patient with him. And of course, I wasn't. I wanted an answer, and I wanted to get this job done, so to speak. But anyway, I chose to, I guess, I don't know if you call it self-publish or not, but I fronted the money for most of the book myself. And I did that because he had several options for me. And the furthest away option that I liked was that he would publish it and they would also promote it, provide the funds. I'm not saying the right word here, but they would handle everything for me. But what was clear to me is that I would lose control of the book. I would then become a subject, and I would have to kowtow if they wanted to remove a chapter or didn't like the picture of my mother or of a fish or whatever it was. And I really wanted to have control of the book. I really wanted the book to look the way I wanted it to look and to say what I wanted it to say. And I realize there's some pitfalls with that because the liability there is that you could certainly come out with an inferior product that maybe didn't have the oversight of the publisher. But I had it professionally edited and I had it professionally published, and all I basically did was kept the majority of the money and investment in the book came from me, so that I had kind of like stocks. I think I had control. So the publisher could tell me, I recommend you don't do this, I recommend you do that. But ultimately, I could make that decision. And so that's what I decided to do. Again, you still work with your publisher. You still have an editor. You still the layout. All of those things you're paying for, but professionals are helping you with that. So it's not like you get a piece of junk or that, you know, I did it myself. I didn't. I had it professionally done, but I put the money in it myself so that I could maintain control, I guess.
So how does that play out in the post-publishing part of it, distribution and promotions and all that?
Yeah. Well, my publisher is still real active in promoting my book in terms of selling it, promoting it. We went to the mall at Christmas, for example, and they set up book signings. And so that is one way he can help you. He also deals with the larger distributors who distribute to larger stores and things. There are certain stores that don't want to talk to you as a writer. They don't want you walking in there with a book and selling them 10 books. They want to deal with one distributing agency that provides them with maybe hundreds of books. And so I can sell the book at home. I can sell it to my neighbor. I can respond to someone who emails me and whatnot, and I can do that on my own. I have the freedom to do that. But my publisher still helps me promote the book. He made posters, promoted my book signings, promoted my book release. There's still a lot of services that they provide for you, and he also controls some of the sales. So it's still in his interest to promote your book, because every book he sells through Amazon or a book distributor, like, say, Todd Communications or somebody, he's going to get a percentage off of that. So for me, it's a good relationship. I've sold a lot of books myself, and for that, I get most of the proceeds. And when I sell to the distributors or through my publisher, I get a lot less, of course. You only get a small cut of the deal. But it's hard for an individual to take advantage of all of the outlets for your book. I don't think you can do that. You know, you might drive around to gift shops this summer, and you might go to a few bookstores, but trying to promote your book all over is just impossible. And I didn't know that. I really thought I would take my book into Safeway to the manager and say, here, I have 40 copies. Would you buy these for this summer? I found out it doesn't work that way. And so, but I'll stop there.
Joseph, how about you? How did you go about getting published?
When I decided that I wanted to do a book, I didn't really know the ins and outs of, like, the publishing business at all. I still don't think I do. So, but I knew that I had just wanted to kind of go the traditional route. And I really have no real reason why. I don't know. I guess I just wanted to see if I could, I guess. I don't know. I'd written in newspapers and things. And so, you know, I had a lot of eyes on my work, but I just, I wanted to just try to see if I could go the, you know, the traditional route and just see if I could do it, I guess, as a personal challenge. And, I've started going to different author talks, and a lot of those, depending on which ones you go to, sometimes they're all about like the book and the story. And then I've been to other ones where it's all about like how the person got published and what they did. And so it's across the board. And I just went to a lot of those and started asking those kind of questions. Like, you know, how did you make the jump to get this book published? You know, did you use an agent or did you not use, you know, did you just peddle it yourself? And, you know, how many tries did it take? And you know, I've talked to a lot of people. I was just at one at KPC last week, and one of the authors there had said she'd sent out over 50 queries before she finally got picked up. And then I know other people who've gotten picked up, you know, right out of the gate. And, so I went to a few of those and asked a lot of important questions, and then just started putting the stories together. And like I said, I took a long time on them, and I tried to put them as many places as I could before I sent them anywhere, because I didn't want to get rejected, you know. And so a lot of the stories in the book, and I do this not so much with newspaper writing because you're on a deadline, but when I write for myself or I write for a magazine or something like this, like it's not uncommon to do, I'll do 9 drafts on a story. Like that is not out of the ordinary for me. And I almost feel like anything less than that, I do feel like I'm just rushing through that story. And sometimes it's something that I'll write and I'll put it away for a little bit and I'll come back. When, you know, when I say a draft, I'm not necessarily doing a major overhaul. Although sometimes I might move sections around and I'd be, you know, this would be a little better up in the front. Maybe I should lead into the story with this action. But sometimes it's just going through and you just tighten up some verbs or tighten up some, you know, just little things like that that actually make the story stronger. So it's, you know, you replace 3 words in a story, it could really change the whole flow. So that's what I mean by a draft sometimes. So yeah, I'll do 9 or 10 drafts. So I had done a whole lot of that before I decided to try to send these things anywhere. And then I talked to a couple folks about where to go. And, you know, if you can get in with the big, you know, New York publishing houses, that's a great thing because, you know, they sort of control everything. I mean, everything's sort of being consolidated into these handful of couple of places. And that's not really me. That's not my cup of tea. You know, I'm really a mom and pop shopper. I'm a mom and pop restaurant eater. And it felt weird going to these big publishers that you knew you were just going to be, you know, just like not have a personal relationship with them. But, you know, at the same time, I didn't know what I was doing and I wanted to make money. So I went to one of the big New York ones right away and I sent everything in. You know, you got to send in your a couple chapters and your bio and all that. And they were really pumped up about it. And they wrote back and they're like, well, we want it to be about, you know, we want an Iditarod book. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do an Iditarod. There's a million Iditarod books out there. That's not what I'm trying to do. Like, and so it didn't hatch with that first one. And then, so then I started looking at sort of the publishers of the books that I like to read, which were these Alaskan Northwest kind of publishing houses, and which was the company that picked me up, which is Graphic Arts Books or Alaskan Northwest Publishing. And I sent it to them and they did like it. They liked it right away. And so we started talking. And, you know, when you go the publishing route, I had already worked in newspapers. So I've worked with editors and different people. And, you know, I've had people go through and pull stuff out of your work that you're really attached to. And I hate it. And I have to admit, and so I knew I would be losing some of that with the book. And you do when you go the traditional route. I had to make a lot of compromises on the title. I had to make a lot of compromises on the cover. Probably the biggest compromise I made is I wanted all the photos in color. Because, I mean, we're talking about some of these huskies are beautiful orange huskies with blue eyes. And they're gorgeous. And, you know, the publisher's looking at everything. And the smaller you go, the more they're crunching the numbers. So it's like, all right, if we do color photos, we've got to sell it at this price. And, you know, our marketing data is saying people aren't buying books that are over this price. And so yeah, you do, you know, you do make a lot of sacrifices when you go that route. You do give up a lot of control. And, yeah, I mean, I guess I found the process both good and bad. I don't know if I would recommend one way or another to anybody else getting into this. I mean, I'm working on a second book right now and I am trying to self-publish that one just to see how different the experience is. And then to see what the return will be too on profits too. Cause like you said, you know, when you go the traditional route, everybody's sort of taken their cut that's helped with the book. And, so I want to kind of do this self-publishing route and see how it goes. And then we'll go from there as to where I go for a potential third book.
And you're just now starting the promotions tour and the book signings and all of that. How much control over that stuff do you do? How much of that are you setting up and how much of that is coming from your publisher?
My book just came out the 4th. So I'm learning as I go. Cause first and foremost, I am like a dog musher, and then second, a writer, and I wouldn't even consider myself a business person of any kind. So yeah, this is all new and foreign and terrible country for me. And they do a lot. They got into a lot of places. You know, it's still being put into places because, you know, the books are being shipped. So it's in bookstores that I've never even heard of in states that I know of, but have never been to. And, you know, they got it in the airport and places like that and gift shops and, you know, things, places where people would go. But there is a fair amount that falls on you, and, you have to beat the bushes a little bit too. And that, I think, has actually been a little bit awkward because, you know, like I said, I wrote this book over 3 years, and then once it's done and you send it in, it's like a year wait between when they accept it and you sort of send them everything until it comes out because they're publishing all their other titles. So the books, it's kind of like a movie when you see these people promoting a movie that they filmed a year ago and they're like, oh, well, this is my character. And so to me, like, this book's been coming out forever. And so I just feel like, okay, you know, it's go time. But the book's really technically only been out 2 weeks. So sometimes I'll make like a, you know, social media post and I'll just be like, oh, you know, please give me a review. And people are like, I haven't even got mine yet. I ordered it on Amazon, but it hasn't even showed up yet, you know? And so to them, it's just come out. Whereas for me, it's, you know, it's 4 years of, you know, it seems like a lot of waiting. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm learning about that. I mean, like I said, everything's social media these days. So, you know, I tried to share it on my page, and, you know, my friends and family have shared it on their page. And then the publicist does everything, you know, they do it in the literary circles, I think, you know, they're getting it into libraries and, like I already said, bookstores and things like that. And cause that's what they know how to do. I don't. So like Mike said, before I did this, I thought you drove around with a box of them in your trunk. And, you know, if you do that, it just doesn't work.
Helpful tips from published authors. So, Mike, you're a little farther along in the promotional realm here than Joseph is. What have you learned from doing book signings and from being out and promoting and spreading the word? Maybe do you have any tips for Joseph as he's starting out this process?
Let me see. So many things have gone through my mind listening to him speak here, and let's see if I can remember even half of them. But I want to go back a little bit to what he said, and it relates to what you asked me. But I agree with him. You know, this is a learning process. It's a work in progress. And I don't pretend to know, you know, one book just doesn't give you, you know, the whole picture. So it all remains to be seen. The other thing is going back to the pros and cons of the way we publish, that is one thing I'm jealous of Joseph on, that larger publisher that has the ability to spread your book nationally, whether it happens or not, but has the ability to, I think is, I'm really envious of. I thought I had a pretty interesting book, and I thought it would appeal to, for example, people on the West Coast. Now, I haven't exhausted my avenues yet, don't get me wrong, but I queried a bunch of bookstores in the Seattle, Portland area. People fish there. People hunt there. I have a famous relative who is a glass artist.
Yes,
there.
Yes, you do.
You know, I thought that they might be interested in a book by Mike Cihulli. And I'll tell you what, everybody I'm emailed and queried, all the bookstores, the standard answer is, we know our readership, and we don't think that our readers are interested in your book. And I'm just flabbergasted by that, you know. And I guess the thing that I've realized all along here, and I'm not saying my book is good, but I do know that Joe or you or anyone here listening to this show could write a book, and it can be a great book. It can be one of the best books you ever read. But that doesn't mean people are going to read it. That doesn't mean it's going to be a Harry Potter book and that you're going to sell millions of copies. If people don't know it, I mean, Joe could have a great book here. And the truth of the matter is half of Seattle might want to read it. But if he doesn't have the right distributor and the right publisher and the right means to make that happen, they'll never know it. And they'll miss out on a good book, you know? So there is a lot, I think, to the marketing and to the distributing aspect of it. And so the question was, what have I learned? I learned that the people closest to you, friends and family, and people who are in your book or have a stake in your book somehow, they want to buy your book. Selling it to the person in Anchorage or Fairbanks who has never heard of you and is just walking into the bookstore and sees your cover, that's a whole different ball game. You know, I sold immediately a lot of books to people who knew me. I've been in Alaska 60 years and I've been in Inilchik a long time. And everybody in Inilchik knew this was, there were a lot of Inilchik stories. So everybody in Inilchik wants that book and they want to read it. They can't wait to find out about so-and-so and so-and-so. But when it comes to selling your book in Seattle or Anchorage to someone off the street who's never heard of you or doesn't know where Inilchik is, or maybe has never fished, believe it or not, even in Alaska. You know, it's a whole different ballgame. That's the question is, how can your book pull people? It might be a good book, but how do you get that person that walks into the bookstore to even read it and or buy it? And I've also found in a disappointing way, and maybe it's the evolution of our society and emails and computers and whatnot, but I'm finding fewer and fewer people read books. You know, I have so many friends that just don't read. It's not that they don't like my book or aren't interested in it. They just don't read. I mean, that's just a fact of life. It's not a criticism, but anyway, it's a reality, I guess.
Yeah, I do think there's going to probably be a luck factor in there, you know, just as in just starting out too. And I mean, you could talk to a lot of other people and, like a great example is, George R. R. Martin, right? Like, Game of Thrones came out in 91, but really didn't take off until, you know, what, 5 or 6 years ago. And then suddenly it just exploded on the scene. And everybody's familiar with J.K. Rowling, too, you know, like living on food stamps or, you know, whatever she did before that thing really took off and she became a millionaire. And so, you know, there, like he said, I've read a lot of great books that you're like, how has this not won awards? And then at the other end of that, I mean, I read a lot of, you know, the year's best series and different little compendiums where they put in, and you're like, how is this story in here? Like, I can't believe this story. Who did they know that the story's in here? So, I mean, some of it is too, you know, there's a little bit of luck factor involved in all of it too. And so I mean, you know, I'm trying to do everything I can from my end and then hope other things fall into place. And like I said, I had spent a lot of time testing the waters of this before I put these out there too, because, you know, through the writing groups and through writing classes. And so that was a good thing too, is because, you know, if I've had 20 people look at a story and 19 are all complaining about that story, that's a story that either needs work or you don't put in there. But then some of these stories, as I started getting into later drafts, and you put those into a writing class and, you know, you've got 20 kids in that class and they all like the story and the teacher likes the story, the instructor likes the story, you know, that's probably a pretty good one to put into the book. You know, you can read your audience in a lot of those things, especially in the writing group that I was in, to give them a quick plug, was the Kenai Peninsula Finer Things Club. It was a really diverse group. There was people in there who wrote war and military stuff. There was some romance writers. There was a children's sci-fi fantasy writer, a horror writer. It was just a little bit of everything in there. And so it was really good because, you know, like, again, if you're just giving it to your family, or if I'm just putting this into dog groups, well, of course, maybe dog people are going to like it, but, you know, I want to get beyond those people. And so if you're giving the story to a person who doesn't own a dog and doesn't care about dogs, and by the end of that, they're like, I really like this story, and they have no reason to tell you that other than it's honest, like they're more than happy to tell you the opposite when they feel that, then I think that that's a really good sign that, okay, these are stories that I should be, you know, pitching. And then again, like I said, the publishers also can give you input too, since they sort of, they know their base, and they did. There was things in my book that got pulled out and stuff. And then there were things that they wanted to pull out. And I'm like, no, that line about the leg lifting fart, that's staying in, you know, like there's stuff that stays in. So it's just, you know, whatever happens.
We all have our realms of the sacred.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about the books for going on an hour here. We haven't actually heard any of the books. Would you all mind reading an excerpt? There's a chapter, if there's a scene, something you were particularly attached to?
The ones I'm attached to, I can't read because I've just, some of this stuff is just too emotional for me. It's embarrassing, but it is. So I'm going to pick something that maybe is not so bad. Are we ready?
If you could describe a little bit what you're going to be reading.
Okay. I'll make this short. It is short. It's the chapter is Stand By for Tones. And this is completely out of context, but I think you'll get the idea. This was a fire that we had on Brody's Road a few years ago, and it's hard to get all of the innuendos in my writing here if you haven't seen what's before and after it, but I think you'll get the idea. So,
all right, go
I'll
ahead.
Just start. Adrenaline was flowing as fast as our hearts could push it through our veins, and Marvin and I had a fire to fight. We could hear sirens of other apparatuses arriving at the scene. I pushed the air brake knob forward in an effort to set the air brake and jumped out of engine one onto the ice. Yes, I said, I pushed the air brake knob forward. It was so slick you could hardly stand up. Marvin bailed and was supposed to chock the truck with 4x4s, but he didn't, and headed directly for the back compartment to don a self-contained breathing apparatus, also known as an SCBA. He and I were both a little wound up, to say the least. I immediately grabbed one of the pre-connect inch-and-a-half attack lines with the intent of laying it out to the fire for Marvin while he packed up. Suddenly, a very sick feeling came over me as I felt the engine begin to roll forward. On the left side of my peripheral vision, while hanging onto the pre-connect that was now only halfway dislodged from the storage trough, I could see two men wrestling in the middle of the road. The truck was headed straight for them and for the dark abyss that was the Ninilchik River at the bottom of Brody Hill.
Excellent. Well, now I want to know what happened, so I guess there's a remedy for that, right? You read the book. Joseph, what do you have for us?
I'm going to go a little longer, but I'm a better writer than I am at reading at people, but I thought you might want something. And so since the whole book is about dogs, but I know you're a cat person.
Oh.
For my one cat story.
Know your audience.
Book. Yeah, that's right. So, and you'd ask questions earlier too about how do you write in such a small town? And I think the thing to do is just, like you said, leave out the names. And, so maybe you could be describing a place, but it could be any place that you've been. And so this is a place that you and I've been together, but we've worked together at three different places now, so it could be any one of them.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah. And, so just to lead in, this story's kind of picking up after, when I did work in an office, what my wife and I would do when she was training for Iditarod is we would go in and we'd work in the office for 8 hours a day. Then we'd come home and we'd run dogs till usually about 1 or 2 in the morning and then kind of put everything away, feed them, sleep a handful of hours, and then go back and do it again. And since our kennel was the size where we couldn't run every dog each day, we were doing that every single day. The dogs were running every other day, but we were doing that every day while trying to hold down a job. And It was just really a poor planning on our part, but this is where this story picks up is me kind of getting ready to go into work the next day after a night of running dogs. With such a hectic schedule, we prearranged as much as possible to shave seconds anywhere we could, and one of my routines before going to bed, including laying out clothes for work the next day. On the eve of my education about needing a mirror, I carried out my usual pre-bedtime ritual. Over a chair, I laid out a pair of khaki pants and a navy blue sweater, then slid under the sheets, hoping to put an end to my sleep-deprived stupor. Instead, a fitful few hours of tossing and turning were as close as I got to sleep. The problem on this occasion wasn't due to a dog, but our cat. He seemed to be trying to best some personal record for how many hairballs he could consecutively retch up, so several times an hour he would emit an awful, unceremonious sound. Wearily, I woke the next morning, did all my usual chores, then pulled on my office civvies and drove to work with Cole. She affectionately pointed out that, as usual, my lower eyelid sagged, exposing the red rims around my irises, but otherwise I looked good enough for another day in the office. To be fair, the place I worked was like a tableau of living people carrying out perfunctory tasks. The place was so lifeless it seemed as if somehow the water cooler had been spiked with Xanax. Short of streaking, emitting a leg-liftingly loud fart, or bringing in a communal baked good that wasn't gluten-free, not much would have gotten my coworkers to raise an eyebrow anyway. I took my position at my own desk that morning, placed a few calls, and typed a story. I, as always, tried my best to drum up small talk with my fellow employees, as well as any living creature who entered the office for another part of the building for any reason. By midday, I had finally slugged back enough of this will that passed for coffee and needed to relieve myself. I strode down the hall to the lavatory, did what I needed to do, and was washing my hands when I glanced in the mirror above the sink. My eyes caught sight of something on the backside of my left shoulder, which had the color and consistency of oatmeal. Leaning into my reflection for a better look, I was aghast to realize I had spent the better part of the day walking around with a dried mound of cat vomit less than a foot from my face. Had this gone unnoticed by my coworkers? Their terminally torpid state made it believable enough that they might have missed seeing my affliction, or perhaps they noticed the puke and were just apathetic about pointing out the upchucked accoutrement to my wardrobe, figuring, if I didn't care about it, why should they? I began replaying every conversation I had that morning, trying to remember who had stood where while talking to me. Then I remembered I had driven in with my wife. How had she missed it? After cleaning myself up, I stormed from the bathroom fuming and called her to demand an answer. Your left shoulder, you say? She asked. That was on the far side from where I was sitting. You can't expect me to catch everything. I don't expect you to catch everything, I countered, but I do expect you to notice if I'm walking around with vomit on my shoulder. You didn't catch it. She had me there. It only made me madder, but it wasn't her fault. I hung up and came to the brooding realization that if you live without a mirror, you've got to expect from time to time to not just end up with egg on your face, but puke on your apparel. A mirror went up in our cabin that weekend.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here. This is Joseph Roberta. His new book, Life with 40 Dogs, is recently released. And Mike Chihuly, Alaska Fish and Fire, has had his book out since October. So what's next for you two? Joseph, you've got a book signing coming up this week at 6:30 p.m. April 20th at Kenai Peninsula College. And Mike, how about you?
I'm not sure what the future holds for me. I've got a number of ideas of things that I would like to write, more on the order of magazine articles. I have had a lot of interest from people, or I should say people telling me, when's the next one coming out? You need to write another book. And so all my writing in my entire life has just been when I'm inspired and when I feel like it. So I'm hoping that that impulse will hit me at some point. I know it won't be this summer when we're fishing and gardening and playing with the grandkids, but maybe this fall it might be time to sit down and think about another book.
Nice. All right. And in the meantime, if people want to read Alaska Fish and Fire, how might they go about getting a copy?
Well, Homer Bookstore has my books, and River City Books in Soldotna has my books. And you could always contact me, email, phone, whatever. I deliver books in Nanilchik, by the way.
Nice.
If you know, it's not so much the money. If a person really wants to read it, I'm tickled to death. I don't know about Joe. You know, money is important, and we need to do the best we can. But the real blessing here is, as he was saying, when someone who doesn't have an interest and has no reason to say it otherwise comes to you and says, you know what, I read your book and I really like it, that makes it all worth it.
Wonderful. And Joseph, where can people get a hold of copies?
It's still so new. It's still making its way into some of the stores, but locally, I know for sure it's in, like he said, it's in River City Books. It's in Already Read Books in Kenai, the big purple place behind the movie theater. And it's in Kenai Feed and Supply, too. And then, of course, Amazon is probably the easiest way for anyone who's outside this area right now.
All right. Well, if you can't bring yourself to patronize your friendly local bookstore, then Amazon is a nice option.
I picked up my copy of Joseph's book today from River City Books, and I'm anxious to read it. So they're definitely there. I know that.
Excellent. Well, we've all got some reading to do then. Well, thank you both for being here. Joseph, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Jenny.
And Mike, nice to have you as well.
Thank you very much.
This has been Kenai Conversation. I'm Jenny Nyman, and you are listening to listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Have a great day.